You know what? I love these Cadbury cream eggs, but I think there's something different about them these days. Or maybe I'm different. I don't know.
Cadbury cream eggs? I don't
Yeah.
get enough of them.
Yeah.
I only get the Easter eggs. They're
I made a really big
not the cool.
mistake.
Okay.
No, the Easter eggs, that's the ones I like, the cream ones.
Not the ones with cream inside. I get the normal ones.
I like the cream ones. I made a big mistake about 5, 6 years ago at where I bought a box after Easter. And let me tell you, you cannot get through a box of cream eggs in a reasonable amount of time. And so by the t at a certain point, they've all hardened and you're tired of eating them. And it ruins something that was really good. And it taught me a lesson because the year before I was at a supermarket and they had, what would you call it, a shopping cart filled with Cadbury cream eggs, like the bottom third. And I was
You.
trying to bargain with them. I'm like, I want to make an offer on all of them.
Oh my
This is
God.
after April. You need to get rid of these and I will make you a good offer. And they were like, I don't know if we can do that. And I was like, how about $60? And we went back and forth for a while and we couldn't work out a deal. Something about they had to scan them all out or something. And so I left without them. But honestly, they did me a favor. I should not have been playing with that devil.
Hello and welcome to the Unnamed Automotive Podcast. My name is Sammy Hajjassad, and with me, as always, is my good friend and fellow automotive journalist, Benjamin Hunting. Say hi to the people, Ben.
Greetings, fellow Cadbury cream egg lovers.
And greetings to everybody who doesn't appreciate the Cadbury cream egg.
Is there such a
Of
person, Sammy?
course! Of course there is.
I feel like Cadbury cream eggs are universal. And if you're listening to this out of sequence, we're recording this in prime Cadbury cream egg hunting time, which is immediately after the Easter season, because I don't know why, but every year, every store overestimates by like a massive factor of 10 how many cream eggs they're actually going to sell. And so they end up with a huge amount of inventory that is instantaneously marked 50% off the
At
day.
least, at least 50% off.
The day after Easter. And I don't, I was talking with Sammy. I think the Cadbury cream eggs are just different than they used to be. And I feel like they kind of harden up more quickly than they used to when I was a kid. So you really got to get in to the sweet spot and peel those eggs out of the clutches of capitalism and put them in your mouth.
Now, that is the voice of fellow automotive journalist and my very good friend, Benjamin Hunting. When he's not providing advice on Cadbury cream egg hunting, he is providing automotive advice and automotive know-how and knowledge.
What are
He's
those things
sharing
I'm
all
paid
of those
for?
things. One of these things you're paid for all over the internet. So, Ben, tell them where you can find where they can find your work.
Sure, you can find my sticky Cadbury cream egg fingerprints over at Motor Trend, at Car and Driver, at Inside Hook, and at Haggerty.
And you can find my work at driving.ca, autotrader.ca, and Electric Autonomy Canada. Ben, listen, I know that you just want to tell me all about how many cream eggs you got this week.
I'm not going to tell you how
I
many
think
I
you're going
have.
to turn off a lot of listeners with all this cream egg talk.
Why? The whimsy of candy is offensive to some people? I don't
I
think
think
so.
that some people are really disgusted by these things.
What is disgusting about an egg made of chocolate?
And the weird cream inside.
Okay, I'll grant you that the cream is neither fish nor fowl,
Okay.
but the egg is merely a shape. It is
So
merely
are
a
you trying to say you think that people who don't like the cream inside should just only eat the egg outside and
It's
leave some sort
possible.
of
You
cream
know,
on?
like when you're a child and you think weird stuff about food, we're
Yeah.
like, when I was a kid, I used to fantasize, and I don't know, maybe this is a real thing, that you could get like a jar of Oreo stuffing,
Yeah.
like the filling, the white stuff in Oreos, and you could just eat it with a spoon and then you could avoid the cookie. And
Oh.
I'm wondering if the same, excuse me, if the same thing is possible for Cadbury cream egg, where I could get like a jar, I guess, or a sleeve, a sleeve.
That sounds so unappetizing.
A sleeve of Cadbury cream egg filling. Now, you might think I sound crazy, but you can go to the supermarket and you can buy a jar of Big Mac sauce, right?
Oof. Yeah, I guess so. Isn't
And
that just
avoid.
Thousand Islands? Isn't that there? Wasn't that what it used to be?
Sammy,
Or
I am not a copyright lawyer, so I don't know
okay.
what they're legally allowed to call it, but I know you can get the sauce without having to eat a burger. So how is it unreasonable for me to get the cream without having to eat the chocolate?
Now, I do think you can get marshmallow stuff. I think it's called
Fluff.
fluff. Fluff? Is that what
Yeah.
it's
Well,
called?
there's
Thank you.
Fluffernutter, and then there's Fluffernutter, and then there's Fluff. But Sammy, where else can you get marshmallow fluff? It's not like it comes in a thing. You know what I'm saying? Like a jar of marshmallow fluff is a question in search of an answer.
No, but you can get
a jar of Oreo stuff is an answer to a question I've been posing my entire life.
Are you nuts? I love those tea cakes overseas.
Oh,
which have marshmallow on. It's like that marshmallow covered in chocolate.
There's a name for them here. Whippets.
Is that what they're called?
Yeah,
but
called
the Whippets have sometimes they have like some jam in there for unnecessary jam.
I know what you're talking about though.
Okay, what are we? We should be talking about cars rather than art.
I have gone hypoglycemic just from this conversation. I
think we have diabetes now. Ben, come on, tell me, what have you been driving recently? You've driven a car that I've heard a lot of really positive things about, and I want to know if you have similar thoughts on it. And that's the 2024 Chevrolet Trax.
That's right. So just when you thought there couldn't be yet another small SUV in the lineup, GM astounds us all by creating one. And if you remember, we talked about the Buick Envista, I want to say in December or January. And the Envista is the fancy pants version of the Trax. It's the same platform. It's a front wheel drive subcompact crossover. It has a turbocharged 3-cylinder engine. And that's pretty much it. Like, there's no beyond that scope of specifications. That's, you would look at that and you think, this is something that I'm not going to be impressed in. And then you would also look and be like, don't they already have the Trailblazer? Like, doesn't that kind of already fill that role? So all these things kind of predispose you to dismiss a vehicle like the Trax right away. Now, we learned a very important lesson with the Kicks many years ago, which was a similar proposition. I mean, Nissan didn't have as many small SUVs kicking around, pardon the pun.
Yeah.
But they, when you look at the Kicks on paper, it's like, this is going to be a joyless experience. And it turned out to be a lot of fun because it's like 2,600 pounds and it's very straightforward and honest in how it drives. The Trax is kind of like a modern Kicks in that sense.
That's good news for people on a budget, right?
Yeah. And that's, thank you for bringing that up, because that's something that is even more important to talk about. We've discussed so many times on the show about how expensive cars are now and how it's hard to find an inexpensive car, period. Like, even if you're shopping for something small, chances are it's going to cost you $30,000. The Trax in the US, the LS model, and keep in mind, they're all front wheel drive, so it's not like you're getting a lot less for your money. It's $21,495, and in Canada, it's $24,500. These are affordable vehicles.
This is really attractive. First of all, mainly because I think it's only $2,000 cheaper than the Buick Envista. So if you find that the Trax is lacking some sort of
styling or
something,
interior, whatever,
you can jump to that Buick model. And then secondly, I mean, I believe the powertrain is very similar to what you can get in the Chevrolet Trailblazer. But the Trailblazer can be had with all-wheel drive. And those are the ones that I think most of the, at least the local press, have driven and I've talked about in the past. And there's something missing about that powertrain and that setup. It just doesn't feel as like engaging or fun or whatever. And I know these are super budget, like subcompact crossovers, but as we've experienced with the Kicks, these things can be kind of enjoyable to drive. And I'm curious if the Trax, unsaddled from the all-wheel drive powertrain, can pull this off.
Okay, so I want to say that, you know, the previous Trax was bigger a little bit, I think. It had a little bit more power as well, I think like 18 more horsepower. And all those things, the original Trax was fine. It was perfectly fine, but it was not something I would recommend. Like, it was okay, but I wouldn't be like, hey, this should be on your list.
This was a rental vehicle special.
In a lot of ways, but it was also pretty decent basic transportation. The new Trax, even though it has less power, 137 horsepower from a turbo 3-cylinder engine, I wouldn't say it's fun to drive, but it is good to drive. I was never cursing out the drivetrain thinking, ugh, why can't I pass this car quicker? Why am I having trouble up this hill, et cetera, et cetera. I had no issues with it at all. The other thing about it is, in terms of its styling inside and out, it is way nicer than the previous generation Trax. It's a sharp looking vehicle. I believe mine was a kind of like a, I wouldn't call it like a powder blue, but like a sky blue. It's a car you can actually get in a color if you want, and the colors look good on it. So it's not just a monochromatic grayscale kind of vehicle like so many entry-level models. Can I interrupt
for a minute?
Yeah, of
course. We're on this discussion on the interior. I'm looking at some photos of this. This interior looks really modern. I mean, there's a massive touchscreen. It looks like there's a digital gauge cluster as well. Like, that looks pretty sharp, man.
There's nothing that's missing from the vehicle that you would think I should have this for the amount of money I paid.
Okay, but hold on now. Really?
Really?
Like, even so, Canadian markets, we're like obsessed with heated upholstery. This has that?
I'm sure you can get it. I don't remember off the top of my head.
You hate heated seats, right?
I do want to say that in the U.S., the maximum price for the Trax is $25,000.
That's it.
That's the amount of money you can spend on the fanciest Trax that's out there. And in Canada, it's $31,000.
Okay, that's the most expensive model. The Canadians,
but you don't have to get that model. And you know, you're probably better off if you're looking for basic transportation to stay away from those models, because you'll get the smaller wheels and, mm-hmm. you know, it'll be lighter. You'll get a little bit more fuel economy. It's 28 miles per gallon in the city, 32 miles per gallon on the highway. I got really good fuel mileage from this vehicle.
That is excellent, actually.
And that's a testament to its small size and its lack of all-wheel drive. And I also drove it during snow conditions and had zero problems. In fact, I drove through some pretty deep snow with it on good tires. There were no issues.
What were the tires, do you know?
I'm not a tire freak like you, so I'm not on my hands and knees every time. I will talk about tires in a few minutes, though, about a different vehicle, because I got a little freaky with those ones.
There you go.
But I mean, Sammy, if you're gonna put this vehicle up against rivals, I guess there's the Kona from Hyundai, or is it the Venue?
It really depends on
the Venue, maybe.
I mean, I think the Venue, because that's front wheel drive only, and it depends if you're willing to discuss non crossovery vehicles like the Kia Soul.
Kia Soul, I think, is a good competitor.
Or Mazda Zero, I think that's not a gas front. Yeah, CX-30 is a good choice because. That's an important car to bring up because it's not super cheap.
No,
but it is fairly fun to drive.
It is more fun to drive than the Trax, but I will put out there that when I'm driving a vehicle in this class, I don't need it to be fun as long as it is competent and comfortable, and I'm not upset with any aspect of it. And with the Trax, it ticks all of those boxes. Like, I don't expect it to be a performance vehicle, and I know the CX-30 is somewhat more engaging from behind the wheel, but realistically, I'm not going to be driving this in situations where I'm pushing it hard. You know what I mean?
Okay. I'm looking at more. The interior is really like captivating me. There are these really like circular vents on the outbound. Like
you love circles.
I do love circles. I only like squircles more. That's all. Those are really funky looking. So again, it's got personality inside, which is rare for a cheap car.
I looked up some of the features you were asking me about. So you can get heated seats, heated steering wheel. I know I had that.
Wow.
You can get a sunroof, which I had as well.
Okay, and cool.
You can get remote start.
Perfect. Yeah, you're right. There is not much more. Wireless Android Auto, maybe?
I think it had that.
Really?
I don't remember. I know I used it, but it's been a few weeks since I've driven it. So that feature is something I'd have to look up again. I just found out that this is actually, the wheelbase is stretched a bit in the current Trax, which explains why the rear seat felt pretty decent.
Compared to the outgoing model?
Yeah, compared to the outgoing model.
Cool.
So if
you were to look at the Buick Envista, I keep forgetting that the Envista has that coupe, whatever you want to call it, that coupe-like profile.
Yeah.
Has like a bit of a sloping rear end. I keep forgetting that.
Not much more than the Trax, but maybe a bit more.
Okay. I was going to say that this might be a little bit more practical.
Perhaps. I mean, it would be a question of a small degree.
Okay.
I think really, if you're choosing between the Envista and the Trax, which I think a lot of people are going to be making that choice, because as you mentioned, they're so close together in price, it's really going to be style. They look similar, but the Buick does have almost like a futuristic EV kind of look to it, even though it's none of those things.
It's very like head turning. Like, yeah. I every time I see one, I'm like, what the?
And if you want to pay more for style, I mean, I'm all for that. If that's what you want in your car, then go for that. Make that choice. I think they're both really good. It's hard for me to think of a cheaper new car that I would recommend over this, like maybe alongside. But I kind of feel like this is maybe a new benchmark for entry-level vehicles.
That's very exciting. I want to take a quick tangent and talk about Buick because...
Because you love Buick as much as you love Squircles.
Almost. But I believe the Trax equivalent back in the day was the Encore. And then the Trailblazer equivalent was the Encore GX or something like that.
I always thought those were the same thing.
I think there's a difference. But what I remember is that Buick was caught off guard by the popularity of the Encore, because I think it was so attractively priced. And for a car company or a brand that's supposed to be a little bit more premium, it's really cool to see how they adapted to people digging their cheaper cars.
It's almost like building a car people want is a successful strategy.
I know. It's so funny to me. And I can't think of another good Buick right now. Other than their cheap one.
I haven't driven a larger Buick in a while. Honestly, I think it's been like the last one might have been the Envision that we drove together. And that must have been, what, 2017, 2018?
It's gone through an entire redesign since then, I think.
It's been a long time. I might have driven an Encore inside of that. But because there hasn't been that much changeover in the lineup. Here in Canada, really, they've been subtracting stuff. Like, we lost the Regal, and we never got the Regal Cross Tour. So
what was it called?
Was it not Cross Tour or something like that?
All Tourx.
Tourx, Regal Tourx, which is unfortunate.
I got it in the end.
Good. That was a good vehicle.
That was cool. Why didn't we get that? It's Who so knows? Annoying that we didn't get that.
Don't deserve it. And the other thing the other thing I've heard about the Tourx is people are worried about parts availability.
Is that because it's European built?
And because GM no longer owns Opel, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know what happens there.
All right, moving on.
Yeah. So, I mean, so for those of you who are familiar, the Regal and its Regal derivatives were all Opel vehicles that have been rebadged as Buicks. Right? Yeah, something like that.
And those are really slick cars. I used to be really big fans of them.
Big Squircle energy.
Yeah, huge. And you're right, that Tourx was a really neat car. It was like a V60 all, what do they call those things? Cross country.
Yeah.
It was like one of those things.
Except they didn't have like a turbocharged and supercharged engine that makes you scared of owning it.
Makes you terrified of any weird noise that you get. Yeah. And they are only weird noises.
All noises are immediately suspect.
Yeah, exactly. It's so funny that Canadians are stuck with get an Outback and you'll like it. That's it.
What are you gonna do?
So tracks under 25 grand, we're talking a really good value. It's got everything you need. It's got space in the rear seats, which is weird for a car that cheap, I suppose. Would you recommend this over a compact sedan? I know that's a crazy question. I know you weren't prepared for it.
I wasn't prepared for it.
And I'm getting you, and you know, we had the whole pre-interview discussion.
Maybe not over a compact sedan, but alongside, definitely. Have like it on your list. If you're driving a Civic, you should also drive a Trax and figure out what personality you like more and what practicality speaks to you better.
Okay, cool.
And also, you know, I don't think the Civic is a particularly stylish vehicle.
No, it's a bit bland nowadays.
So, I mean, Trax and Invista are the opposite end of that spectrum, but in the same pricing ballpark.
Okay. All right, cool. Let's quickly change gears and talk about a vehicle that I've learned starts at twice the price of the tracks you just mentioned. And that's the 2024 Dodge Hornet. It was a hybrid, right? The plug-in hybrid?
Yeah, the plug-in hybrid. It's the RT.
What a great way to market RT, which I assume used to mean racing technology?
Road and track, Sammy. Road and
track. Oh, road and track. I think. Sorry.
I don't know.
Whatever.
Who can keep up?
We can make it up all the time. I didn't even know that there was a non-hybrid version of the Hornet. I thought it was hybrid only.
Hybrid only. No, there's multiple versions of the Hornet. It starts at... So for those of you who aren't familiar, Dodge has come out with... Dodge has had some weird things go on with its entry-level cars over the last decade. They came out with a car called the Dart in 2016 or 2015. And
if you needed headroom, this is where this car struggled, because somehow nobody had headroom
or rear seat room. It was like when Cadillac came out with the ATS. Here's what happened. They brought over platforms from Europe that did not work in a North American context because they were not large enough to be comfortable. And the Dart was essentially dead on arrival. When I see one these days, it's an event. Like, it's very rare for me to see one. And that was the only small entry-level vehicle that Dodge had in its lineup. And then Dodge kind of just got rid of everything that wasn't a Challenger, a Durango, or a Charger, right? Mm-hmm. I think they made minivans for a while, then they stopped, and they made them again. Anyway, confusing branding. So now they're kind of repeating history by bringing over another European platform from Alfa Romeo. I believe the Alfa Romeo Tonale. Oh, yes.
Everyone knows that you would, if you struggled with the Fiat or the, I think it was a Fiat platform in the back in the day, wasn't it?
You tell me. I don't know.
Maybe it was an Alfa platform too. That they should, yeah, you're right. You're just repeating the same playbook.
So it's the Tonale, I believe, what it's called for Alfa Romeo. And it's like a tall hatchback is the best way I could put it. Okay. And they call it the Hornet, which is weird because as far as I know, Dodge never made a Hornet.
Okay.
Historically, what does that mean? Well, there was a car called the AMC Hornet, American Motors, in the 70s. And then Chrysler kind of bought American Motors in the 80s.
Not kind of, did they?
Well, I don't know.
Kind of?
Well, they wanted Jeep, right? And American Motors was like, you got to take everything.
They're a package deal, just like me and you on the playground.
Something like that. And I can't remember how much. I know that the Eagle came with that too. And it was a complicated transaction. But what I'm asking is, if you buy another company, do you get to like take their heritage and then put your own badge on it?
I'm going to say yes. Only answer. Yeah.
Okay.
That's what we've seen happen.
So that's what happened.
The Datsun, right? Like,
I'm sorry?
Well, Datsun wasn't purchased by Nissan, was it?
No, Datsun just changed its name.
Yeah, you're right.
It's not confusing to anyone.
No, that's not confusing.
So 2024, I guess maybe 2023. I don't know exactly when the Hornet came out.
You weren't paying attention.
Well, it was a staggered release, I think.
it's okay.
This hatchback comes out, and you can get a base model, a GT. Then there's GT Plus, RT and RT Plus. And
now plus what?
Don't worry about it. And in the in the US, it starts at 31 grand, goes up to 46. And in Canada, it starts at, I had the number here. And it has disappeared. Okay, here we go.
For the non-hybrid model.
The non-hybrid model starts at 43,000.
DOA, done. This is not being sold by anybody.
And the hybrid model is $53,600, including $5,000 of rebates from the government.
Including the rebate. Yeah, no, this is over. They've already lost this game. On to the next alpha-based failure that they're going to bring out.
Sammy, you're not going to believe this. So I'm looking live at the Dodge.ca building tool for the Hornet, right?
Yeah.
Remember I just told you it had 5,000 in rebates?
Yeah.
I moved my mouse on the screen flashed, and now it says includes a total of $10,000 in government rebates for $49,000 price. Sammy, is Dodge spying on us actively?
Yeah, I think so. I definitely think so. But that's a problem. That's problematic pricing, Ben. Like, it's that's really not good. Especially for the non-hybrid model. Now, you drove the hybrid. Tell me what that means.
Sammy, what it means is you could buy a Durango for less money than a hybrid. Than the vehicle. And you could buy an all-wheel drive Durango. So let's kind of back things up and talk about what the Hornet is. I mentioned it's a tall hatchback. The RT is a turbo four-cylinder that has a – let me make sure I'm getting that information right. It is a – 1.3-liter four-cylinder engine with a electric motor at the rear axle. Altogether, it's 288 horsepower and 383 pound-feet of torque maximum. Now, I bring that up because – in order to access all of that power, you have to use something that Dodge calls power shot, which while you're driving and presumably have a fully charged battery, you pull both of the steering wheel paddles for shifting at the same time and hold them. And then this like little whirlwind kind of appears on the gauge cluster, like it's a little icon, and you get 15 seconds of 30 horsepower, I believe.
30 more horsepower.
No. 30 horsepower. More horsepower than if you're driving around normally.
Yeah.
Okay. So that 288 number, I believe you have to subtract 30 unless you're in sport mode using power shot.
That doesn't sound okay. So that's got to have 30 horsepower is a lot. That's good.
But it does have like, you know, I said 383 pound feet of torque, right? That kind of makes me
plenty.
Yeah. That makes you think like the RT badge isn't just advertising like this. Maybe this is going to be fun to drive and fast. So this was a really weird driving experience.
Oh no, what do you mean by that?
This car, like, it has functional hood scoops, it has a Hornet on the outside, it has, I believe my vehicle had Brembo brakes, because it's a bunch of different packages you can get to, like,
make it has it a massive electric battery, so it's what, 5,000 pounds?
It has a massive electric battery that gives you 50 kilometers or 32 miles of battery-only driving, which I can tell you in the real world is legit.
Okay,
fine. It fully reaches its potential on the stat sheet that way. Where it doesn't necessarily live up to the hype is in a straight line. So, like...
What? But the power shot, Ben...
I had
power shot.
Power shot did absolutely nothing.
What do you mean it did nothing?
So
where did the 30 horsepower go?
Sammy, I wish I knew. MIA horses, maybe they escaped through a gap in the fence. Not clear. But the Hornet does not feel particularly fast off the line. Where it does feel quick is accelerating to pass someone. I found like I had enough power at all times, but it never threw me back. It never really made me go, whoa, or like, you know, smile or anything like that. And then I figured maybe it's because I'm not using power shot. So I try using power shot in the same situations, almost no difference. Like I couldn't, it seemed to feel quicker without using power shot, which was just weird. And then I started researching. I found Car and Driver did an instrumented test of this vehicle. So they had the vehicle doing 0 to 60 in 5.5 seconds, which is pretty fast. That's like a half second within a half second of my Cadillac, which also has 400 pound feet of torque and probably weighs like a similar amount given that it doesn't have a battery, but is much larger. So they tried using power shot and apparently, Dodge said that it will take 1.5 seconds off the 0 to 60 time, which seems like kind of a crazy claim to make for 30 horsepower. And maybe that's a typo, but they found it trimmed. It just cut 0.2 seconds from 0 to 60 and the quarter mile.
Heard that it is slightly more noticeable while in motion.
Well, for me, it was more noticeable while in motion,
But not off the line,
not off the line. And even in motion, it's really like a crapshoot. And 15 seconds is a long time. That's like, long enough to notice.
Yeah, what are you doing? What are you doing after it? Yeah.
When's the last time you were full throttle for 15 seconds?
Yeah, you try to think about.
And we're drag racing a minivan.
Exactly. Modern cars can do a lot in 15 seconds. Yeah. That's right.
So I was unimpressed with the power of the vehicle. I did not find it to be engaging to drive from a throttle perspective. It just wasn't great. It was totally fine most of the time, but nothing about it really screamed performance. When you're on battery power alone, I was able to get that great range, like I said, but the vehicle was strange in the sense that it was not good at telling me whether it was in battery mode or hybrid mode. And sometimes it would say battery mode on the dash and I could hear the engine running.
This is 4xE all over again, isn't it?
And then like 3 or 4 seconds
later.
Didn't
that happen so many times with us when we would boot 4xE, battery save, and then it's like, no, the battery is clearly working now. The gas engine is off.
Yeah, and it would, when it would eventually catch up to what was actually happening on the car and it would tell me it was in hybrid mode, I would like try to put it back in electric mode because there was no reason for it to be in hybrid mode. And then it would say electric mode not available temporarily. And then like 5 seconds later, it would let me do it.
And it's so like opaque about what completely. The difference is.
Yeah. And there's also, I think, only 112 horsepower available when you're in electric mode. So that was okay in most circumstances, but uphill a couple of times, it had to break out the gas motor. And off the line, a few instances, it decided it was going to turn the gas motor on as well, even though I wasn't really accelerating that quickly. It says it can go 118 miles per hour on the battery alone. Interesting. But a lot of that stuff is dependent on temperature, like state of charge of the battery, temperature of the battery, external temperature, that kind of stuff. So those are probably, as you mentioned, opaque factors that the driver isn't going to necessarily be able to figure out. Sorry, 118 miles an hour is the top speed that Car and Driver got on the car. Dodge says it'll do 128, and you can do 84 of that on the electric motor alone. I was able to cruise around at 80 miles an hour with no problems on flat stretches of highway.
With no gas. With no gas intervention.
Just battery.
That sounds pretty decent. again, it always feels like there's decent parts in some of these new Stellantis vehicles that don't mesh, that don't play well together, and they need like refinement in a number of ways, yeah. Right?
And the other question is, like, who is this vehicle for? Like,
the pricing is out of whack. The so pricing that's my major issue with that question.
The pricing is a problem. If I'm spending $50,000, it's not on a Hornet RT. I'm sorry, mm-hmm. It's not. Maybe if it was 35,
yeah,
or even 40, it might make a little more sense.
But I mean, when you've got the Canadians buying the gas model for 40 grand,
yeah. It's
difficult.
It feels like the vehicle has been set up to fail in that sense. The other thing is, it looks a little weird. Like, it's not an attractive vehicle. It's not an ugly vehicle. It just doesn't have much personality. They try, like I said, they tried to give it scoops and badges and stuff mm-hmm. to make it look aggressive, and it doesn't really work. The interior is fine, but there's nothing amazing about it. There was enough space. I stuffed mine full of tires. I bought some new tires for the Datsun.
Yeah, you tagged me in that.
Perfect. I did. You didn't respond. Sorry. I had no idea whether you saw it. I went to bed not knowing. That wasn't a good feeling, Sammy.
Several days gone by.
I was embarrassed to bring it up because, like, what if you did say something and I just didn't notice and then I'm the problem?
Yeah.
In any case, I was able to fit 4 15-inch racing tires in it with the seats down. No problems there. So that's a decent amount of cargo space. But
I'm also looking at the cabin. The infotainment system looks pretty modern, and there's a lot of physical controls in here.
Sure.
So those got to be some advantages for Stellantis. I mean, that. Uconnect has never been an issue for, well, you, they, I should watch my words here.
Are you worried that Dodge is listening now and they're going to flash a Uconnect ad across your computer screen?
I'm sure people have had issues with Uconnect.
Trade your son for Uconnect.
But it is one of the more, I think, not popular. What's the best word to say? Like, user-friendly infotainment systems. Yes. On the market, I think. And I'm looking at this cabin. I'm loving all the physical controls in here. That looks pretty good.
You love getting physical. There is a nice button on the steering wheel on the left that allows you to cycle through hybrid, electric, and battery save mode. And there's
It doesn't. You press the button.
You press the button, and there's a delay, and you wait to see what pops up on the screen. That is true. There's also a physical sport button, which I appreciated. Okay. You didn't have to go into a menu to get to various functions for that.
Oh yeah, that's cool. That's smart. I love that.
Yeah. Anyway, it's not a bad vehicle. It's just not great. It's very okay, and the pricing suggests great. So that's my biggest issue with it. I did like the fact that it did not lie about its battery range. More vehicles should take a page from the Hornet's book in that respect.
Did you find it efficient when that range was depleted?
Yes, actually. I actually got some really good numbers because I was almost always in battery mode, but when I picked it up, I can't remember what my state of charge was. So I will look now. I have an app that tracks all of this stuff.
And is it a regular transmission for that gas motor?
It's not
a CVT, is it?
It's not a CVT. I don't know how many speeds. Let me check. I know that the gas only model, which is 268 horsepower and a 9-speed automatic, that's the $32,000 one.
Mm-hmm.
Let me check the transmission here. It's a 6-speed.
Okay. Interesting.
It looks like I did not do a ton of driving with the, I would say probably 50% of my driving was with the battery empty.
Okay.
And I got 4.25 and 4.89 liters per 100 kilometers.
It's not bad.
That's really good. Let me translate that into miles per gallon.
That's over 40, I think.
55.
Wow, it's over 50. Holy moly.
So I want you to keep in mind that most of my local driving was done on battery, but those two sessions where you're seeing the really far, the 55 miles per gallon, that would be me driving 30 miles on battery, then switching to gas with an empty battery and driving another 40 miles. So about 50%.
Typically like highway speeds, you think?
Yeah, it would be highway speeds. So
these things I've always thought, like, you know, we want more gears in our modern cars for better efficiency. But for some of these vehicles, especially like a plug-in, like you just mentioned, they're probably needing a really tall gear in the transmission for highway coasting, really, right?
Yeah.
And they can get away with really good efficiency at that end.
I was impressed with the efficiency of it. So, but like, why couldn't I get this efficient package minus the performance stuff? Like, I don't really care if the Hornet does 5.5 seconds.
Work. If the power shot didn't, if the power shot worked, maybe you'd be more impressed.
I think maybe I'm just so jaded that 5.5 seconds doesn't feel fast anymore.
Oh, that's true. 5.5 seconds is enough. It's plenty.
You know, so it's, but 5.5 seconds is being presented as a performance vehicle. And
what does this compete with?
Nothing. I mean, like, what other $50,000 hatchback is there? First of all,
I mean, Nero PHEV.
No,
but that's super cheap.
And the power is not even close to the same.
Exactly.
I mean, this is like Golf R pricing, I think. If you really want to drill down into hatchbacks that have performance, and it's similar pricing to the Civic Type R as well. And these are not comparable driving experiences. No. It's almost like they're two different poles. So that's weird.
I mean, I was looking at it as a PHEV, like hatchback.
No, I know, but I was looking at like that power and then hatchback and price, you know? Yeah. And it's like, it would be a hard sell for me.
This is in some weird space of a Venn diagram of these vehicles.
Yeah. And even if you're like, well, you know, you don't want a manual transmission, well, you can get an automatic in the Golf R. So these vehicles are within orbit of each other, which is the oddest thing I've ever said. When's the last time Dodge made a vehicle that was in orbit with the Golf R?
SRT 4, maybe.
Oh, there was the Golf R wasn't even being sold in North America.
Really?
Back then, was it? When did the first R32 come?
I thought R32s were like eternal.
No, I think it was like mid 2000s or something like that. But that even then, that's like a sedan versus a hatch.
2003.
Yeah, but
when did the SRT 4 happen?
But when did?
Okay, I'm thinking. Sorry, Caliber SRT 4. I said.
Oh, Caliber SRT.
Just regular SRT 4?
Yeah.
Happened in 2004. No, 2003 to 2005. Yeah, but they existed.
Did the R32 come to the North American market in 2003?
I doubt.
I don't think so.
I think so.
I thought it was later. Because we skipped a bunch of Golf R's.
2004.
Okay. And that's the one that had the VR6.
2004 model year, yeah.
That had the VR6, right?
I believe.
And it was like super heavy in the front.
So, holy moly.
Anyway.
Yes, getting, VR6.
We're going down a rabbit hole here.
A Wikipedia thing here. Okay, cool. But, yeah, that was the last time. That's a long time. That's 20 years ago.
Yeah. I can't remember, as we established earlier on this afternoon, 2 hours ago.
Okay. Now, before we finish today's episode, I want to bring up a listener question. We've got some feedback from Rob, who messaged us about a new about a problem he's got. Really, he's in the market for a new vehicle.
It's a good problem to have.
Yeah, he's in the market for a new vehicle, and he's thinking electric. But he, first of all, is not 100% on the idea due to range anxiety, which I think is you know, justifiable. He's test driven the Taycan, and he found it. He found some deficiencies there. He also test drove the related e-tron GT, and he liked that. He drove a Lucid Touring as well as a BMW i7. So these are four electric sedans that are on the market.
Similar price points. He's
looking for some advice on those. Now, I'm going to point out he had a few notes. He said the Taycan felt a little small in the cabin and that the suspension was too stiff. And I think those are totally reasonable complaints to have with this vehicle. It is one of the truest four-door sports cars on the market. Sorry to the Maxima out there, but it very much feels like a tight car inside and not super family friendly, if that's something that Rob is worried about. Or even super practical in the trunk or frunk. And I think the e-tron GT is pretty much the same car, but it's probably a little bit softer.
It's definitely softer. I like the e-tron GT, but I drove the RS model, which is kind of crazy. So
that's true.
That I think that papers over a lot of what people don't like about the base models.
Okay. Now,
and I use base model very lightly when describing these vehicles because they are expensive and they are quick.
Yeah, super expensive. Well, I mean, relative. It's all relative. Maybe Rob, this is not a worry to Rob here, but Lucid. There's a lot of high praise for Lucid.
Everyone I know who's driven one like them. I have been trying to get behind the wheel. There is a Lucid dealership in Montreal, and I can they will do short test drives, but I told them I really wanted to wait until I could have a long-term loan. And I've spoken to Lucid US, and they don't have a press fleet here in Canada. They've invited me to their HQ in New York and out the HQ out on the West Coast. And if I went to a major city in the US, they could hook me up with a loaner. I haven't been able to take them up on that yet. I'm super curious about the Air and also about the new SUV. But I believe Rob's concerns were annoyances that people are having that he's read about online, like doors, locks, build quality, that kind of thing. That's really tough for people like us to pick up on in short periods of time.
But it's reasonable. It's understandable because as a new automaker, they've got like a teething process.
It's hard to build cars. It's just hard. It's
consistently. It's hard to build cars consistently.
It is a real industrial process that I think requires a huge amount of experience. And some startups are able to hire that experience away from other companies, and some aren't as successful at that.
Absolutely. Now, one of the final vehicles that Rob brought up is one that I think we're probably going to sing a few praises on, and that's the BMW i7.
Shout out to a year ago this month when the i7 was my oasis during an ice storm that knocked out power to Montreal. And I basically lived in the i7 for a 48-hour period.
And you bonded with the i7 at that
bonded,
point.
So. I worked from it. I watched TV on the giant screen. Look, I really like the i7. As much as I like the e-tron, I really like the i7 just in terms of its versatility. Rob nailed it when he said it's, you know, quiet, comfortable, luxurious. It has tons of space. BMW build quality is excellent.
Mm-hmm. And right now, it's killing it.
If you weren't feeling the Porsche out of this list, I would probably push towards the BMW because it's the most known of all of the ones that we like the most. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense, it's the known quantity. BMW has been building some pretty good EVs for the last little while. I have not heard bad things about their electric drivetrains.
Yeah, I agree. I even, honestly, the i4 isn't a half bad choice too. If you want to get the ultra high performance, like the M50 model or M40 model.
But the i4 will be more cramped inside. That's
yes,
for sure.
Of course. But that's a performance machine.
And I just had the i5, like, which I really, really liked. If the i5 was not small inside, Rob, if you wanted to add that to your list, I know each of the cars you've listed are like executive sized sedans. So if that's where you're shopping, then I get it. But the i5 might be worth a look because of, you know, a little bit smaller, a little bit more nimble, and I really liked it. But of the list that you had,
and it's good in terms of like, it's good in terms of price to performance, right?
For sure,
you're getting a lot of car for your money there.
But of the vehicles you listed, I would push for the i7.
I would agree with that.
I think the Lucid is probably a good choice too, but I just can't personally vouch for it.
Yeah, we haven't had enough hands-on experience with that, and I know there's a lot of secondhand stuff, but I don't know how comfortable I feel with that. Have you heard about like another automaker that's really struggling? You heard about Fisker and the Ocean?
I don't
even
want to talk about it.
Okay, one blew my mind.
Anyone who has a deposit for a Fisker, I'm sorry. That process has gone really bad for everybody.
I want to hear from you. Honestly, message us. Let us know what happened.
Yeah, if you've interacted with Fisker, I'd be curious to know how they're handling the whole situation. For those who aren't familiar, remember when we said it was hard to build cars? Well, Fisker has discovered that firsthand, and they've had nothing but problems with this Ocean SUV that they brought out. And it's too bad because people were really excited that there was another competitor, another kind of boutique EV maker that was making a go of it in North America. And they've amply illustrated why, you know, even a company like Tesla coming out with something like the Cybertruck and kind of falling on its face with all the problems they've had with the body and the quality issues. I mean, Tesla's been here for a long time now, and that didn't work for them. For Fisker to come out and just really completely collapse immediately out of the gate, it's really discouraging.
Yeah, it's tough. And I don't know, you know, how much more legs they've got. I think they're really hoping that somebody would help absorb them. And I don't think that's working out for them.
But we had another message from Mark, who wrote in to talk to us and kind of we had reviewed the Polestar V60 on a recent show. I believe it was the last show. And he is an owner of the vehicle. He has a 2023, and he found our review to be fair and accurate, especially when it came to, we were talking about, Sammy, remember specifically changing the suspension settings and how I thought that probably no one who owned one of these cars would be jacking up the car and making those changes. And Mark confirms that he will never do that, even though he's a mechanically inclined person. He just doesn't see the point because the car is balanced and great in terms of handling and ride comfort already. So like, why mess with a thing that is already a bit of a hassle, or more than a bit of a hassle to mess with? And it was nice to see that I'm not crazy in thinking that this is something that maybe Volvo needs to address if they want in the next generation car. You know, he compared it to Porsche's lap timer, the sport chrono option.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is really accurate.
Yeah, no one's really using those.
No one uses that. And like, I go to the track regularly and I use my phone to track my lap times because I can do so much with that data using various apps, right? Whereas if I'm just using the car to track it, I mean, my Datsun has never been near a chronometer. My Datsun's definition of a chronometer is the analog clock that's on the dashboard, right? Like it's like an old wooden ship's chronometer. Sorry. So, yeah, I agree that most people are not using Sport Chrono to time lapse.
He also mentioned, you know, that he found the infotainment system, you know, similarly, like, you know, it had its learning curve. But he also said he doesn't mind the logging into Spotify onto Android Automotive OS. That seemed to be no issue to him, which is something that we were curious about, how people would feel logging into another, you know, device with their credentials, right?
And the other
maybe we were overestimating it.
And the other thing that I thought was interesting was we had mentioned, you know, how the V60 had similar cargo space to or a little bit more than a Volkswagen Golf. And Mark also owns a Golf, a Golf TDI.
And this is a man of the people here.
He decided to keep it after buying the Brilliant. Model, even though he had originally planned to sell it. And it's nice because, as he says, you get these two very different driving experiences. Mm-hmm. Where that he described the PlayStation feel of the Volvo, which is a term that Sammy and I have used to describe other cars in the past, versus the, you know, the communication that you get from the Golf. Mm-hmm. In any case, Mark, thanks so much for writing in. It's really nice to hear from people who have real world experiences with the cars that we drive, because we only get them usually for a week or two at a time. And, you know, you're living with this car and your impressions of what it's like to day in, day out, deal with these kinds of issues or features that might be frustrating for us, but we discover that they're easier to use over time. That's really helpful.
To learn something, right? Like it works. So thank you, Mark. I appreciate that.
I really wish more people would chime in with their own experience with cars. Like we had the great Vyacheslav wrote in with his great experience. Well, his terrible experience, but very well told about what happened with his Tesla in an accident and what that was like. And that's something that, you know, we will rarely, if ever, get to deal with firsthand. So having that information is extremely helpful.
Now, Ben, next week, actually, I'm going to give a call for some people if they're curious. I've got two vehicles to talk about next week, and I'm going to be directly comparing them to one another, and that's a Toyota Grand Highlander and the Lexus TX. Now, we've discussed these vehicles in the past, but I think it's really cool to talk about how much value a luxury brand actually brings, and I want to hear from what people are curious about with these two vehicles. So, you know, why don't you guys head on over to our website, unnamedautomotivepodcast.com, and go to our contact us form and fill it out and let me know what you want to know about these two cars, and we'll talk about it next week.
And if you want to contact us in other ways, you can find me on Instagram where I'm at Hunting Benjamin, and you can find Sammy on X if anyone's still using X.
I'm trying to extract myself from X.
It's so hard. They keep pulling you back in just when you thought you were out. You can find him at Sammy_ha, like you're laughing, or you can email me the old fashioned way, Benjamin@BenjaminHunting.com. If you like the podcast, please let your friends know about it or leave a review or a comment or a star rating. Whatever it takes on your platform is very helpful to get more people listening to the show, which is always nice. Just expand the audience and hear from more people and get the unnamed automotive podcast message out to a bigger crowd.
Yeah, we love it.
Next week, I'm going to be driving and talking about the Land Rover Defender 130, which is a vehicle we've talked about on the podcast in the past, except this time the version that I have has all of that like funky off-road gear that you see, like the ladders and the bubble on the side and all the other stuff. So I'm testing out like how practical it is to actually use that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting.
Yeah, so I can't wait to hear it. It's weird because it's huge, right? And anyways, it's going to be an interesting conversation.
Spoiler alert, I like the Defender in this format. I mentioned that in the past, but I'm not totally sold on the accessories. So that's going to be another conversation.
Okay, we need to hear about that next week, okay?
Yes.
We didn't even get a chance to address the fact that we missed last week's episode.
Yeah, sorry about
that. Due to technical logistical issues,
yeah,
right?
What happened was the power went out at my house for 14 hours, and that sucked.
We're just glad that you were able to stay warm, really.
So what I ended up doing was buying a house battery. I researched, because I ultimately wanted some kind of generator, but generator versus battery, it's a whole conversation. The batteries themselves are quiet. They're reasonably priced right now in terms of comparing them to a generator, and they charge pretty quickly. So I ended up with a 2 kilowatt battery from a company called EcoFlow, and it can charge in an hour on a plug, either from a car or from a 110-volt plug at a house. So I'm thinking that it's probably going to be enough to see me through shorter outages in the future, and hopefully that means the next time the power goes out in my, you know, forested area, which seems to happen on a regular basis, we'll be able to record the show.
Yeah, that's the priority, of course.
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.